Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a cold January afternoon yesterday as Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man opened inauguration celebrations at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. But everything about the day, the sight, the passion, the president-elect, brought to mind a hot August day in 1963 in the heart of the civil rights struggle when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stood on the same spot and said, "I have a dream." This hour On Point, the untold story of King's dream speech as the country prepares to inaugurate Barack Obama. You can join the conversation on this Martin Luther King Day. Is this the dream? Part of it, at least, coming true. We'll be joined in a moment by a scholar who calls King's speech national scripture. But first, we check in on Washington. A huge crowd turned out yesterday for Mary J. Blige, Bono, Garth Brooks, Bruce Springsteen, and more. Mike Allen is chief political correspondent for Politico.com. He was there. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So give us the feeling, the mood. It was cold out there. What was the mood, Mike?
It was cold. It wasn't frigid. It could have been much worse. And, Tom, it was incredible to stand up on the slope of the Lincoln Memorial and then look back toward the Capitol. And all along the reflecting pool, hundreds deep, hundreds of thousands of people gathering as early as 8 in the morning in order to salute their coming president. There was a lone light in the dome of the Capitol. So as you look down, you saw this huge swath of people who waited very quietly. Then you saw the Washington Monument sort of framing them, and they sort of like dribbled back toward the Capitol. And this was such an incredible sight that a lot of people in the press pen turned around and watched the concert with their backs to the performers so that we could see this amazing crowd joining in Shout and American Pie and This Land Is Your Land.
Garth Brooks there, Sheryl Crow, John Mellencamp, and Usher, Shakira, Jamie Foxx, Queen Latifah. Denzel Washington was there, one of many actors who came and spoke at the kickoff to Obama's inauguration. Let's listen.
We end this ceremony that begins this inaugural week with three simple words that speak to who we are and to our future. And they are, we are one.
We are one, said Denzel Washington yesterday on the Mall. And Mike, what was your sense? Not one, but maybe as many as 400,000 people there, I'm reading. That just a fraction of what's expected for tomorrow, Tuesday. What's your sense of who was there and from where, Mike?
Well, there were all kinds of people. It was a very non-cynical crowd. You had even some reporters, people who are used to covering things, who were down there with their families. A lot of people from out of town, a big African-American crowd, which you could tell in part by the reaction to as various figures were mentioned. Mm. And so it's people who just want to be a part of this. Everyone in the country is going to know where they were when Barack Obama was inaugurated. And these are people who are lucky enough and are able to be in Washington. You know, John Meacham writes in the new commemorative issue of Newsweek that Barack Obama's inauguration will be written about as long as there is an English language. I asked some of my readers, is Barack Obama's inauguration in the top three events in American history? Certainly you also have the emancipation of the slaves up there, certainly 9/11. Is it in the top 10? Is it the top 20? And the answers I got back added a few military events and men walking on the moon. So people are thinking of it in the sweep of American history in those sorts of terms. Tom, how amazingly lucky are we to be alive for watching, talking about something that's as big as men walking on the moon.
It is quite a moment in this country's history. Mike Allen with Politico.com. Mike, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for your great coverage.
Mike Allen there yesterday on the Mall in Washington, and of course much more to come this week. Joining me now from New York is Eric Sundquist, professor of literature at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is author of To Wake, The Nation's Race in the Making of American Literature. His new book, looking at the origins and consequences of Martin Luther King's most famous speech, is King's Dream. Eric Sundquist, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
I have a dream. Everyone, or nearly everyone, knows this speech. I read in your book surveys showing that there is maybe no other piece of rhetoric, political rhetoric, maybe no rhetoric in American history and culture as well known as this one. But there's a lot, I think, that many people do not know about this speech, including that it wasn't exactly the speech Martin Luther King came to give, Eric Sundquist.
That's exactly right. And it's one of the ironies of history that a speech that we consider perhaps the greatest speech in American history, at least since the time of Lincoln, one of the great speeches of the 20th century in its entirety, probably wouldn't be remembered as a great speech, might not even be remembered as an important speech other than the marking the occasion itself, which saw a number of other speeches that were powerful in their own right, but for the fact that King set aside towards the end of his speech his concluding paragraph for any of a number of reasons. There's a great deal of speculation about what caused him to change his mind and deliver extemporaneously the part of the speech by which it's best known today, not simply the cadences, "I have a dream," which give it its famous tagline, but the concluding oration where he quotes from "My country, 'tis of thee," and asks for freedom to ring from one mountaintop to another across the nation, east and west, and concludes with the powerhouse words of that old Negro spiritual, "Free at last." All of that, although much of it King had used in other speeches dating back for a number of years, none of that was in the text that was before King as he stood at the podium on August 28th. Now, some people speculate that he heard Mahalia Jackson call out in the background, "Tell about the dream, Martin." Mm. I think it's possible that his interest in the dream was triggered by hearing Joachim Prince use the metaphor of the dream in his speech earlier in the day. King himself would later say that he just decided he wanted to use something that he'd used before. He wasn't quite sure why, but it just seemed right. So he decided to set aside his rather bland conclusion and give the part of the speech by which it's best known.
August 28th, 1963, the heart of the civil rights era struggle. It got harder before it got easier. Let's listen to some of the prepared text. Here, very early in the speech, Martin Luther King giving his sense of the moment in history. This is before he went spontaneous with the "I Have a Dream" portion early on that day in that speech.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free.
Martin Luther King, on those same steps of the Lincoln Memorial where we saw Barack Obama and his family and that enormous crowd stretched out before yesterday, the prepared text from August 28th, 1963, very early in the speech, it wasn't exactly a softball. 100 years later, the Negro still is not free, Eric Sundquist. It's not as though he came with nothing to say on that day.
No, he had a great deal to say, and I think most everything King did during the year 1963 was propelled by his deep consciousness that it was the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, his allusion to Lincoln in that portion that was just played without naming him, to that great American. He called many other black leaders great Americans, Medgar Evers, Frederick Douglass. He himself, I believe, recognized that he was becoming a great American alongside Lincoln. He had a lot to say and was conscious of the fact that he, to use a metaphor that he introduced in the next piece of the speech, was the one to deliver a second Emancipation Proclamation and perhaps bring closer to fulfillment that promissory note that was signed by the architects of the Republic, not just 100 years earlier, but 150 years earlier. And so he was conscious of moving back not only to Lincoln, but to the founders themselves, moving forward from them to Brown versus Board of Education, another promissory note, and bringing to a potential conclusion a promise that had been made, an exodus that had been set in motion many years earlier.
You know,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Martin Luther King's famous speech at the Lincoln Memorial, the untold story of the I Have a Dream speech, and its loud echoes this week. Behind me, Mahalia Jackson. She was there in 1963, August 28th, when King gave that speech, singing this song, not in this performance, but this was the song. Eric Sundquist is with us. His new book, and it's quite a marvelous book, is King's Dream. If you think you know this speech inside and out, there's more. And he tells it beautifully in his deep sort of exegesis of King's speech on that day. I Have a Dream. Eric Sundquist joins us from New York. Dr. King was there. The movement was on. It had already been tough. Many had been beaten and jailed. People had died, and more would, including Dr. King himself. What was his goal on this day, the March on Washington, Eric Sundquist?
Well, I think his goal was to Ralph Abernathy, his closest friend and aide, would later refer to the speech as a prophecy of pure hope. That makes it sound perhaps more highly idealized and less pragmatic than it actually was and King intended it to be. But there was a sense that the nation was ready to hear a black man speak to them as an equal, to speak to them in a commanding way, making demands but making them in a reassuring and calm manner. He spoke inclusively of the need for blacks and whites to work together. We cannot walk alone, he said. He counseled African Americans not to approach whites with a sense of uncertainty or bitterness, but to see them as brothers. So it was a speech made to a nation, and certainly because of media coverage to the world, it was a speech that had many of the characteristics of a powerful sermon, and he, of course, quoted from the Bible. And in almost every occasion of his public speeching, he was giving a sermon as well as making a political argument. But one of the things that, to my mind, is most remarkable about the improvised section of the speech is that it gave a highly metaphoric and beautifully poetic dramatization of what I think was the essence of the speech, that it was a kind of constitutional argument for the necessity of black citizenship rights by seeing the nation as a set of interlinked mountain tops, mountain ranges from New England through the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, the curvaceous slopes of California, and not excluding Stone Mountain. King was rebutting states' rights in favor of national rights, and he was insisting, as he often did, that the dream was not just material prosperity. It wasn't even something as simple as equal opportunity. It was, in fact, the nation itself. America was the dream, but the dream would not be fulfilled until America was the nation that it set out to be in 1776.
Fulfilled not just for black Americans, but for all Americans. No Americans would fully realize that. You write, he was saying, until all did. I want to go to that moment that you described where he, listen here, as he's beginning to wrap up his prepared text, you hear then not exactly a falter and then the turn to a dream. Let's just hear this junction in that famous speech, August 28th, 1963. He's exhorting the crowd to go back and do what's necessary, and then you'll hear the turn.
Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
And then it would go on the riff that all Americans know. Did Mahalia Jackson really say, tell them about the dream? Martin, we don't hear it there, Eric, but something moved him to spring off that written page and out into ideas he knew well, but not a prepared text.
Yes, certainly some have speculated that Mahalia Jackson said, tell about the dream, Martin. Apparently she was heard saying that by some. But in her own autobiography, in which she describes in moving and rather glorious terms her rendition of I've been buked and I've been scorned, which you just played earlier in the program, she doesn't mention that. Now, there's no reason that she would call attention to herself necessarily, but it's odd that she doesn't mention it. So it may have been Mahalia Jackson. King himself didn't mention her. He simply said, well, I decided I wanted to use something different, something I'd used before. And it's important to underscore that although it's extemporized, it was indeed part of King's repertoire by that point. It was a kind of set speech. He'd used the I Have a Dream as early as 1962, and there's speculation about where that came from originally in his usage. His quotation from My Country, 'Tis of Thee, and the whole the cadenza of Let Freedom Ring, that dates back to at least 1956, and indeed, as I point out and as other scholars have noted before me, he borrowed much of that from a speech given by Archibald Carey, black alderman and minister from Chicago at the 1952 Republican National Convention. So King had used these pieces of the speech in variations on a variety of occasions leading up to August 1963. But what's most striking to me is that although that's the case, although he was calling upon things from memory, this is easily the most poetic, melodic, the most beautifully put together and constructed rendition of that set piece in his repertoire. So in that sense, he really was calling on his deepest resources of creativity. And I have the sense, too, although I would be interested to know what people who were in the immediate audience thought that he thought perhaps that he hadn't quite reached the crowd the way he wanted to, and he certainly would have recognized that the ending of the speech that he had written was bland by comparison. It was a rather routine call to return to the community, go back, organize, get ready to climb higher mountains. More obstacles will be set in our way, but we must go forward and not look back. It was a perfectly fine conclusion, but it was not a soaring oration. And I think he realized that it simply didn't have the resonance that he wanted on this occasion.
Not to that point, but before it was finished, he had gone all the way back into the deepest wells of American political discourse, and then deeper still into the Gospels and the Old Testament, into Isaiah, you remind us, and Daniel and Amos, back to the stories of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, all that in the great soaring finish to this enormous speech. We want to know how it sounded on that day, and we have listeners, Dr. Sundquist, who were there. Let's go to Elaine calling from Boston. Hello, Elaine. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking this call. I am 86 years old, and I was at that march with my children and my husband. And it was an unbelievable experience. We are an African-American family. We had traveled there from Boston, and we had never, ever expected to be at a place and in a place where we could hear the cause of African-Americans being heard, being spoken about so eloquently. All of the speakers were stunning.
Elaine, when you think back on that speech that day, 1963, so many years ago, now you're 86 and Barack Obama is about to be inaugurated, what does that say, and maybe what does it not say to you about where the country's come?
Well, what it says to me is that this is an unbelievable moment, too, because I, among many of my friends, said it could never happen. And they have, many of them who said it could, have been delighted to find that I was wrong. However, I think this is just the beginning, because we know that the health disparities and all of the issues that still exist for African Americans and other people who have been oppressed in this country still exist. My children all were so inspired by that moment that I have five children, and most of them have gone into some form of work that addresses these issues. I even have a son who became a Black Panther. So we were very moved, and we also were delighted that in the Eyes on the Prize showing of that crowd, our family is there.
That's a piece of history, and you take us right back to that day. Elaine, thank you so much for your call. Let's dive right on from the moment we heard to the refrain that the whole country knows so well. This is long, as Martin Luther King unfolds spontaneously that day, the I Have a Dream portion of the speech.
I have a dream that one day,
yes,
this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Yes.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together.
Dr. Martin Luther King, August 28th, 1963. We're joined by Eric Sundquist. His new book is King's Dream. And right now, as well from Alexandria, Virginia, by Reverend Dr. Howard John Wesley. He's pastor at the Alfred Street Baptist Church in Alexandria, a fourth-generation Baptist preacher. Reverend Wesley, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I do not believe you were born when Dr. King gave that speech. How does it resonate as you listen to it on this day in this year of all years?
You know, it still sends rippling effects through me as a young African-American man raised by a father who was there and shared with me his memories and reflections of what that day meant. And now just to see, you know, where we are, it's almost like a continuing legacy, another leg in a relay race that has been run. And I stand upon great shoulders of men like Dr. King and my father and others. And so this speech is timeless, it's eternal, it continues to make, almost sometimes make me cry, and sometimes make me angry, sometimes make me motivated. It really runs the gamut of emotions within me as a young African-American male.
Powerfully emotive speech, but what about its importance in the realm of ideas, Reverend Wesley? What idea did it most plant, as you listen to it now, that continued to unfold in these decades since?
Well, one, I would say, is the successful strategy of nonviolence. Usually the youth, especially young black men, when confronted with these type of isms and the injustices that Dr. King spoke of, are very quick to have a violent and militant attitude, as obviously seen and endorsed by some of the policies of the Black Panther movement. You know, but it continues to remind me that the peaceful, nonviolent way is the way of the Lord that we proclaim, that we follow, and has brought us to this successful moment where we are now, where unity and love has definitely outweighed violence and hatred.
Eric Sundquist, Coretta Scott King said of that speech that day that it seemed to come from some higher place, and her words, for that brief moment, the kingdom of God seemed to have come on earth. Eric, that's a pretty high characterization of any moment, the highest.
It certainly is the highest, and I think it's important to recognize, and the clips you've played underscored in a variety of ways, that King not only spoke as a minister, but he spoke with a sense that the cause of the nation, the elevation of the nation, was a transcendent cause. It was a cause with a moral intensity and from his point of view, a biblical character that exceeded the nation. It embraced the world. It exceeded the world of man and embraced the world of God. He uses the phrase "all of God's children" three times in the speech, and he means that, I think, not simply as a kind of rhetorical tagline, as we might hear it in many speeches, but he was making the point that Lincoln made when he said that all of God's creatures are embraced by the promise of the Declaration of Independence. The two streams of thought, the biblical, the Christian stream, the doctrine of nonviolence, and the constitutional stream, the promise of America, were a single stream for King.
When I was younger, they said, boy, you're going to be president, just like everything else. Those old crazy dreams kind of came.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Martin Luther King's most famous speech, the Lincoln Memorial, the untold story of the I Have a Dream speech, and looking at its loud echoes this week. Eric Sundquist is with us from New York. He's author of the new book, King's Dream, about how deep was the root that went into the speech and the turn Dr. King made in the speech from prepared text to familiar ideas, but put in a way, at a time, in a setting that made them, he says, part of America's new national scripture. Reverend Dr. Howard John Wesley is with us as well. He studied Martin Luther King's work at Boston University, where Martin Luther King got his PhD, of course, in theology, where we broadcast from today. President-elect Barack Obama standing at that same spot yesterday before hundreds of thousands. In his speech, you can hear a reference, we'll talk about it, to King.
Directly in front of us is a pool that still reflects the dream of a king and the glory of a people who marched and bled so that their children might be judged
by their character's content. And behind me, watching over the Union he saved, sits the man who in so many ways made this day possible.
A reference, I guess, there to Martin Luther King and, of course, to Abraham Lincoln. Eric Sundquist, did you hear that reference yesterday? What did you make of it? It was an unusual way of putting it, the reflecting pool reflecting the dream of a king.
I didn't hear it when the comment was made yesterday, but it's characteristic, I think, of President-elect Obama's linking of himself to King and even to Lincoln, that he's determined to do so because he sees himself within that lineage. They are his two most often named symbolically alluded to heroes. But he often, in the case of King, refrains from naming him by name in his convention speech, for example, and then again in his election night speech. He didn't mention King by name. He called him the preacher from Atlanta or the preacher mm-hmm. from Georgia. Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, it's whether it's conscious or not, it's not unlike King's own way of introducing Lincoln in the dream speech when he says, 50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. Lincoln is not named, but King, perhaps more powerfully for doing it subtly, takes on his mantle against the backdrop of the Washington Memorial. And we might say that Obama is doing something similar symbolically by he actually uses the word king, but he doesn't call him Dr. King. He is a king reflected in the pool and against the backdrop of the Lincoln Memorial, again with Lincoln not needing to be named in order to be a presiding presence.
Reverend Wesley, I wonder what you made of that. The dream of a king. There's a kind of Christian reference there too, of course. Jesus often referred to in those terms in the New Testament, in the Christian Gospel. At the same time, to me, it was a little bit subtle, given what's unfolding this week, given he was on the very spot where Martin Luther King stood and spoke. How did you hear it?
Well, I heard it. It definitely had a subtle tone to it, but I could appreciate, once again, why Obama uses language like that. It makes his entire administration, his entire campaign, and his vision very palatable. One thing I really admired about the campaign that I thought I might have found offensive was the way he avoided polarizing extremes or any type of language that just labeled him as an African-American candidate. Because once again, like Dr. King, mm-hmm. I believe Obama realizes this has to be a totality of Americans coming together and that we cannot use that which pushes us to different extremes. And so I thought I would be offended, but actually I can embrace it as part of who Obama is.
Let's go to Don in Grinnell, Iowa. Don, you're on the air.
Hello. I too was there in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
In 1963, Don?
That's right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I was reminded when Dr. King reached My Country Tis of Thee, Sweet Land of Liberty, of the occasion when another great African-American, Marian Anderson, sang that same hymn in the concert some 25 years earlier, I believe, after she had been barred from singing in Constitution Hall, and Eleanor Roosevelt and Harold Ickes arranged for her to sing in front of the Lincoln Memorial. So that was an echo, so to speak, which certainly I heard. And I've often wondered if Dr. King somehow, perhaps subconsciously, himself thought of Marian Anderson's recital.
Eric Sundquist, of course, My Country Tis of Thee, the lyrics right there in the I Have a Dream portion of the speech, very prominently quoted by Dr. King, from every mountainside let freedom ring, and then, of course, him saying, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true, and so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire and New York, Pennsylvania, and right on down. What about the Marian Anderson predicate to that, Eric Sunstein, and Dr. King's usage of it in 1963?
I think the caller is exactly right that King would have been very conscious of Marian Anderson's performance in 1939 on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, in which she included America in her program. It was one of many instances over the course of African American history in which the lyrics of "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" have been used as a way to frame the question of black rights, reaching back indeed to the abolitionists who used the song in ways that were sometimes satiric. "My Country, 'Tis of Thee, Sweet Land of Slavery," for example, was one way in which the Garrisonians reframed it. And so it has a long history of which Marian Anderson is a part and of which King was himself consciously a part. He referred to Marian Anderson alongside Rosa Parks on a number of occasions as someone brought forth by the zeitgeist, by the spirit of the time, as a necessary step on the road to justice. And I think it's also important to note about his use of the quotations from American, specifically the idea of the letting freedom ring, is that he's looking at such things as the Liberty Bell, which was frequently used by abolitionists who noted that its inscription is "Proclaim liberty throughout the land." From Leviticus, he was implicitly looking back to "Lift Every Voice and Sing" by the James Weldon Johnson and his brother, which includes the idea of a bell ringing with the harmonies of liberty. He was, to be more contemporaneous, he was alluding implicitly to a song that had a lot of popularity at the moment, Pete Seeger's "If I Had a Hammer," which had been covered by Peter, Paul, and Mary in 1962, and then again by Trini Lopez in 1963.
And Pete Seeger again yesterday in 2009.
Yeah, exactly. So "If I Had a Hammer" speaks of the bell of freedom ringing all over the land. So King was pulling together a network of allusions in a remarkably powerful way.
Don in Grinnell, who was there, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to North Carolina, Charlotte, and Kirsten. Kirsten, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Kirsten?
I agree 100% with the gentleman earlier that stated that it has to be the total landscape of Americans that embrace the idea of equality, and that certainly I believe that Obama is in touch with that, and that he does recognize that Dr. King believed that all of us had to work together to get here, that this is not, we do not live in isolation. And it all seems to echo around each other, that I don't think that all of these things happening are coincidence. I think one person's actions have opened up the door for the next person's actions to even be acceptable.
And certainly Obama, very much on that theme of these messages mattering for everyone, though they've mattered in different ways, certainly over the years. Kirsten, thanks. Let me get one more right here from Gail in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm referring to the question that was asked, was Dr. King's speech as important for white people as for black people? I think it's a very interesting question. I do think it was absolutely as important, but did white people especially then recognize that? No. The reason being white privilege. And I think most of our listeners may or may not know what I'm talking about, but probably do. Being born without discrimination against you means you don't have to look into discrimination. You don't have to ask questions about it. You don't have to understand it.
It was just natural as the air many people breathed in those days, Gail.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So I don't think white people recognized or felt the need to recognize. In fact, but many did. And I don't think white women do feel discrimination. People of white skin of different cultures do feel discrimination. I don't mean to exclude them in my comments.
Gail, thank you very much for that. Eric Sundquist, Dr. King then, and Barack Obama, again yesterday in a clip we played, talking about characters, the content of our character, as King put it. Obama with a slight twist on that by their character's content yesterday, beyond color. But it's if you slide too easily beyond color, you certainly miss a lot of history, Eric Sundquist.
That's certainly true, and I think the two colors together raise a profound question, not just about what the content of King's dream was, but about what has been inherited and made possible with the election of Barack Obama. Just to very briefly mention that one of the phrases from King that Obama quotes most often, among several, but one that stands out is his use of the idea that all of us are wrapped in a single garment of destiny. All the peoples of the nation must come together to realize the ideals of America. But more to the point, all the peoples of the world are wrapped in a single garment of destiny from Obama's point of view. But to speak specifically to the question of the content of our character, that, of course, has become a flashpoint for arguments about the meaning of King's dream. Conservatives arguing on the one hand that it incarnates King's colorblind ideal, in which he hoped his the nation in which he hoped his children would one day live when they wouldn't be judged by the color of their skin. And the conservative take on that is that this is an argument against affirmative action and in favor of various colorblind constitutional and legal principles that would truly bring about King's dream. The counter to that, of course, is that King on any number of occasions made quite explicit his support for what we now think of as affirmative action, at least different manifestations of it. But underlying that question is the deeper one that while it was true that King held out the goal of colorblind justice, what he was most interested in, and there's a very strong undercurrent to this effect in the dream speech, but one that had to be muted for the occasion, is economic justice. What occupied his time and his thinking more and more over the course of the few years left to him. To bring about true racial justice, he realized, meant bringing about economic justice, because it was the economic disparities more than anything else that were the result of longstanding racism and segregation, and would be the very hardest thing to root out and correct.
And
in that
today,
sense, the dream is still unfulfilled.
Reverend Wesley, you've said that this speech was important because in many ways it gave blacks a finish line. What do you mean by that?
Well, it helped us set the goal. It lifted it, one, to the national consciousness. But then with black people, here's where we are. Here is the definitive vision, the voice, the dream of what we believe that this civil rights movement, that the fight for equality and liberation was all about, and it was put succinctly in a way that we could stand behind it. Now, obviously, we had heard and were motivated by different ideals of what our civil rights movement was about and what we thought the end game really was. But this became the definitive voice, the final vision upon which even now, still young blacks and even people fighting for justice all around the world will reach back to a speech that is almost, you know, more than 40 years old and use that as helping identify, here's how we're going to do it and here's what it's all about. So it becomes timeless. And helping us see what our real goal is.
Here's the conclusion of that famous speech, August 28, 1963.
Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., 1963. Eric Sundquist, we just have 30 seconds left. As you listen to the inauguration tomorrow, what of this speech will be on your mind?
Well, that conclusion, which I think takes King back to his biblical references from Isaiah, the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together. It was a demand that the citizens of the nation, if the glory of the Lord, if the secular ideals of the nation were to be revealed, they had to stand side by side. They had to join hands. They had to reconcile the American patriotic song and the African-American spiritual and make them the single message of the nation. That's what I will be listening for in President Obama's speech tomorrow.
A preacher in 1963 delivering Eric Sundquist's new national scripture. His book is King's Dream. Eric Sundquist, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
And Reverend Dr. Howard John Wesley at the Alfred Street Baptist Church in Alexandria, Virginia. Thank you very much, Reverend Wesley.
Thank you.
We'll go out with Bruce Springsteen and The Rising from yesterday on the Mall in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.